and it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, we have Champ Chipman in conversation with Greg T. Daniel, directing Top Dog Underdog, currently running at the Pasadena Playhouse. Last week, we heard a bit about Mr. Daniel, and now a bit more about the play and his involvement with Pasadena Playhouse.
Danny Feldman, their producing artistic director, has been there about 8 years, has seen my work around town. I have my own theater company. I also am a freelance director. So Danny's been seeing my work over the years. And I know the Pasadena Playhouse likes to hire in-state directors. They don't always feel like they have to go to New York or Chicago or even London to get directors. So he approached me about directing the play. But I think that it stems from having seen my work doing all this Wilson around town and doing other plays around town and thinking I was the right fit. So we had a conversation. I couldn't believe they were reviving this play because, oh God, over 2 decades it has not been produced in Los Angeles. So I was even kind of surprised when I first saw the season. I thought, Top Dog, Underdog, well, that's a really done pearl right there. What's up with that? And finally, Danny and I had a conversation. We talked about it, and I guess he decided I was the right fit. So that's my association. Before then, though, I had been an actor at the Pasadena Playhouse. I did Jitney by August Wilson, started at South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa, and we moved it into the Pasadena Playhouse when Sheldon Epps was still the artistic director. So I've been on their stages before, but this is my debut there as a director. But again, I always tell students I work with, you don't know who's going to see your work, so make sure it's good. Make sure the work you put out there, you're proud of, because you never know. Someone will call you or contact you and say, hey, I saw you do, oh my God, that was like 5, 6, 7 years. Yeah, but we have a project we're doing. Come on in and let's have a conversation about it. He's been terrific. The staff under Danny's leadership has been wonderful to work with the Pasadena Play. They are fully behind this play and actually passionate by the fact that they want more people to know Top Dog Underdog. A lot of people will go, a Top Dog Underdog, I've heard of that play, but I've never seen it. Why? It's one of the great American plays. It should be seen along Streetcar Named Desire and Long Day's Journey, The Glass Menagerie. Why isn't this play being produced more? So I feel like we have a mission in some ways. I think the Pasadena shares in that. We can expose L.A. audiences to this beautiful work, which won the playwright at Pulitzer Prize in 2002, first African-American female to win a Pulitzer Prize in drama. We're sharing this and exposing it to a whole generation of theatergoers and non-theatergoers who are curious about, well, what is that play about, Top Dog Underdog? So, yeah, we run until March 23rd at the Pasadena Playhouse. That's like a plug, isn't it? But hey, that's what we're talking about. It's a remarkable piece of material. The Pulitzer's got it right in awarding this playwright a Pulitzer Prize for drama. And what I love about it, even though it was done in 2002, we're treating it as if it was a new play because the themes within the play are still as resonant as it was in the early 2000s. So we're treating this as if it was a new play. And in many ways it is because so many people don't know, have never seen the play. People come to me all the time during intermission or afterwards saying, is this a new play? Or, where was this play? Where did you find this play? So we are educating a whole new audience to Susie Laurie Parks, the playwright, and Top Dog Underdog.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of that, being a previously established story by Susan Laurie Parks, can you think of any changes between what the audience will see at the Pasadena Playhouse as opposed to the Broadway performance in the early 2000s?
And there was another Broadway revival done about 2 years ago with Corey Hawkins in it that did very well. I don't know how long they were at. In fact, they won Best Revival. They received a Tony Award for Best Revival of a Play. But it hadn't been done in New York for quite some time. I just like to think we're in a different time now. So it's not so much state-wise, New York to the West Coast. But look at the time we've gone through the pandemic. We've gone through the murder of George Floyd. We've gone through EDI, and now suddenly EDI is being vilified. Just socially, politically right now, we're in a very challenging time. And I like to think the upheaval that's happening in our world, in our community, in our nation, indicative of this play, this upheaval between the brothers, because they really very much believe in the American dream. Whether they know it or not, they're trying to rise. They're trying to change their social circumstances. They're legitimately trying to buy into, well, yeah, I'd like to live better than what we're living. I'd like to be able to have a fine job with benefits, et cetera. So, again, I think politics and socially and culturally what's going on in America, this sounds a little daunting, but is reflected in the play. It reflects the times that we're in. It's a good enough play and a strong enough material to reflect the conflict between the brothers and their attempt at reconciliation. It's very much what we're struggling with, our conflicts or our values as we reassess them. And now we're under a new administration, so suddenly there's a lot to reassess a lot to be afraid about, but there's a lot to try and reconcile as well. So I think that politically, socially, the times that we're in help give the play a kind of resonance and a kind of tension.
Absolutely. Could you please give us a brief synopsis for those who have never heard of Top Dog Underdog?
Sure. It's a play about family. It's a play about two brothers who haven't been abandoned by their parents early on. They sort of were each other, depending on each other, are still trying to form a family with each other.
Mm-hmm.
What's sort of humorous about it is that they named the two brothers Lincoln and Booth. Of course, Booth, who assassinated Abraham Lincoln at the Ford Theater in D.C., so there's this twist in that their names are Lincoln and Booth. What a wonderful sort of a conceit she sets up.
Yep.
But it's really trying how they reconcile themselves. How do they get past this legacy of pain, abandonment, betrayal that happened with their parents? So how do they heal?
Mm-hmm.
It's really how do they heal themselves, how they heal each other, how do they form a family,
mm-hmm.
these two brothers, having only known a world which certainly has not been kind to them, certainly has not been. Now, having said that, there's a lot of humor in it. I don't want people walking away thinking, oh, my God, this is going to be a social experiment.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to bludge us over there. There's so much comedy. Well, the fact that one of the brothers is a Lincoln impersonator, where he puts on white face and put on the beard and the Lincoln get up, and he works at an arcade, and people pay to come in and shoot him in the head as Lincoln was assassinated. So one of the brothers is a Lincoln impersonator. That already sets up, this has got to be some fun in this. There's
right.
Funny about this. A guy who has a black man who has a job as a Lincoln impersonator,
mm-hmm.
and people pay to come in and shoot him in the back of the head. There's got to be some comedy in
yep.
there. So, but that's basically it. It's about family and our need to form family, to define what is family, to reconcile ourselves with our family. So you will get it. I think people will naturally begin to invest. I've had so many people say, oh, that was my brother. Oh, that was like my sibling. But just when you think you know what the play is about
mm-hmm.
and how it's going to go, this playwright, this daring, bold, and amazingly talented play, turns it upside down. And that's the one I can't tell.
Okay.
But I guarantee you Susie Laurie-Parks turned it upside down. And all the expectations that we set up from the play, from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
are suddenly sent upside down by Act Two.
Gotcha. That sounds really exciting. Yeah.
That intrigues people. And, of course, it's about the world of three-card Monty, because one of the other brothers is trying to make a living being a three-card Monty. For those who don't know that, it's almost like a shell game. You guess which card is the black card or the red card, and
mm-hmm.
they have a cardboard box and no crates, and they toss the cards. And, of course, the spectator has to choose which is the black card, which is the deuce, which is the red card, which is the heart. And it's an old, old scam that goes back to time immemorial. But one mm-hmm. of the brothers is trying to be a three-card Monty scam artist. So she sets these really wonderful, outrageous situations up, and she delivers. The playwright really delivers on them.
Got you. Could you tell us more about what has the production process been like for this show? Did you hold auditions? Did you have
yes.
actors already in mind? Take us through the process of day zero to premiere.
Both. We had a casting director who reached mm-hmm. out to actors in the industry that we thought might be good for the roles,
mm-hmm.
but then we also brought in actors from agent submissions, and we held quite a number of days of auditions. I must say there's a lot of talent out here, particularly African-American, so we saw some terrific people, and it came down to chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Could we believe these two as brothers? Do they have enough range and versatility to tell us they're brothers and do all the things the play require? But it was a fair and open call, and there were terrific actors that came in. And again, as I said earlier, they might not have gotten the role because we were looking for a kind of chemistry between the brothers, and we found it in the two actors that we ultimately cast.
Gotcha. Okay. So tell us more about the two brothers that you did end up selecting.
Brandon Gill and Brandon Michael Hall. And believe me, you couldn't write something like that, that we wound up casting two actors, both named Brandon.
Right.
No, we didn't do it on purpose. It just happened to be the luck of the draw. They both named Brandon.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable actors who came in. We had them read together, and that's when we knew. We had them doing a scene or something together, and that's when you knew, okay, this combination feels right. This combination is going to work. It's a short rehearsal period, so we have a lot to accomplish. And
mm-hmm.
you have to have actors who have the range, have the discipline, have the commitment to be able to get there. And they also realized this was a special play. This is like a tour de force for any actor
mm-hmm.
to hold a stage for that long period of time, just two of you. So they came in locked and loaded. They came in ready to work. I recall that we would end rehearsal and they would go back to one of their apartments or places and they would run lines.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something I told them to do, but I heard, oh, yeah, as soon as rehearsal finished, they went over to Brandon's house, this one's house, and they started running lines because there's a lot of language, lots of language the two of them have to memorize and do. So we hit gold Not that there weren't other actors we could have used, but as I was saying, these two just had the right chemistry and had the right interest level. I think you'll really fall in love with these two guys in that you want them to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
We had to believe that the audience would invest in them as if it was their brother, as if
right.
it was their relative. We really wanted the audience to fall in love with these guys and want them to succeed, which makes what happens later even tougher emotionally to get mm-hmm. through. And I'm not saying what happens later, but so their charm, you know, their versatility just hit all the right notes. So Brandon Michael Hall and Brandon Gill mm-hmm. are the two actors inhabiting Lincoln and Booth in Top Dog Underdog.
Awesome. Speaking of the two brothers, are there any of your own personal experiences as the director that you may have implemented into these two main characters? Or on the flip side, are there any personal experiences of the actors that may have been implemented into the characters to kind of give them a unique spin as opposed to the original story done by Susan Lori Parks?
Great question. Absolutely. We sat down for the first couple of days and we just, what we call table work,
mm-hmm.
where we not only read a play and talk about the situations and the scenes, but we also share things because the play sort of engendered that. Mm-hmm. I shared things about my brother or my relationship, certainly with my family and most of Brandon's, where they grew up, what their sibling relationships were like. You can't help but bring that to this discussion that we would have, just laying the groundwork for a relationship between these two guys and also a relationship for all of us. So we spent at least 2 or 3 days of rehearsal just discussing the play, but also discussing who we were, how it relates to the play, those things that they found resonant and poignant in the play and it relates to their lives. So we opened ourselves up in terms of being vulnerable and sharing things, sometimes very painful,
mm-hmm.
sometimes very painful. Sometimes things were said that were just shared that were painful, but they had the courage to say, you know, I'm in a safe space here. Let me share this about my sister or my brother or my parents or a situation I had when I was in high school or in mm-hmm. college. We laid out cards on the table mm-hmm. and shared things with each other that only deepened our knowledge of each other and made us sort of, oh, yeah, I know who this guy is. So I'm getting to know who this actor is or this director mm-hmm. is. So, yeah, I shared things in my past that related to the play. They shared things in their past and present that related to the play. And it was a really nice, fertile conversations we were having that made me feel even more confident these were the right actors, their ability to be candid, to be honest, and to be able to share that.
Mm-hmm.
That makes up a lot of character relationships and working relationships. You know, theater is not one of those, you start at 9 and you clock out at 5 and you put everything aside in your life until then. No, you bring your life, quirky, idiosyncratic, whatever, you bring it to the theater and you share it with others.
Absolutely.
So we had a really fertile and wonderful time just doing the table work and learning about each other.
I would imagine that being able to share these vulnerable moments with each other really helped bolster the camaraderie and help improve the chemistry of the play and
great
the
word.
Set and
camaraderie.
Production.
That's right. We all build up a camaraderie. We're exactly there for each other because we wanted to help each other to soar the best we could with material like this. We're so inspired by Ms. Parks and what she wrote that we all wanted to bring our A game. And the camaraderie as a result of those conversations and those candid conversations, they went a long way in establishing trust. It really gave us a sense of trust in each other. So once you have that, once you start with that foundation, you can go anywhere.
Absolutely. You know, there seems to be some reoccurring themes about family, uplifting each other. What is an important message that you hope to convey to the audiences of Top Dog Underdog? When they leave the show, what is something that you want to stick with the crowd?
I just want them to be able to fully embrace this family that they see on stage. If they can leave themselves open and embrace and take in and invest in these characters, whatever they'll take away in terms of how it affects them because everyone is unique. So I think the strength is in variety
mm-hmm.
that rather than one message going out throughout the audience that everyone gets,
mm-hmm.
that all these varied shadings they're able to leave with, and it's valid. It's absolutely valid that whatever your orientation was to the play and to these guys,
mm-hmm.
as long as you dealt with them and embraced them and had empathy for them, you're entitled to whatever your reaction is going to be. So again, family is the great preoccupation of American drama. I mean, so many of the greatest plays are written about family.
Mm-hmm.
It's the preoccupation of American drama. August Wilson, all about family. I mean, Raising the Sun, all about family. Glass Menagerie, all about
mm-hmm.
family. I want people to be able to reflect on their own family and their own relationships with family and siblings. And if they can just drop the mask and feel they can take that in, then I think we have done our job because we made you vulnerable. We helped you to be vulnerable and care about these two individuals.
Nice.
That's Greg Daniel in conversation with KVCR's Champ Chipman. We are hearing mainly about Top Dog Underdog, currently running at the Pasadena Playhouse through March 23rd. Also, they have a program where you can purchase a ticket and have it saved for someone who, due to being impacted by the recent LA fires, might not be able to otherwise make it to the production.
You have such an extensive background. I was doing my homework on your career, and I was just curious, how has your tenure in the realm of acting helped you feel more comfortable as a director, or are these two completely different fields?
I think my acting has helped my directing. My directing has helped my acting. Okay. I think the two of them have fed the other. I mean, as an actor, I'm only concerned with doing the role and the scenes that I do, which is great. That's what I should be concerned about. But as a director, there's so many other factors I have to work with: the designers, lighting, sound, set, costume. I get a larger playground because I'm also directing and curating those. But one feeds the other, that when I speak to my actors, I know the actor's language because I am an actor myself. So when I'm directing actors, I like to consider myself an actor's director because I know the language they speak. I know the worlds in which they dwell. So that helps me to relate to them. And then as a director, of course, being an actor, I know visually what I want to see. Again, how I want to sort of calibrate what the relationships are. So one feeds the other. One definitely feeds the other. I think I'm a much better actor because I direct, and I think I'm a much better director because I act. It's just having intimate knowledge of those worlds and how they intertwine. Every actor wants to give a good performance. There's no one you're going to cast in something that wants to give a bad performance.
Right.
So what should I as a director say to them that will help them? And every actor works differently. Some get it right away. I've had actors with their first week, boom, they're there. And then I've had actors that it takes them a good 3 weeks to develop. So how do I find their entry points and get them where I need them to be?
Got you. Could you talk more about the aspect of pay it forward and what that means to you in this production?
I work in theaters across the country sometimes, which were PWIs, primarily white institutions. And when I go in now, I insist the design team be varied and diverse. Sometimes there are plays that don't have to be cast with just Caucasian actors. So can we consider an Asian actor? Can we consider a Native American actor? Can we consider an African-American actor? So there are ways of paying it forward in that now that I've gained entry into it, how can I bring someone along with me? I always use an assistant director. I always find some young person who's interested in directing and see if the theater will engage them to be my assistant so they get a chance to, again, go into the institutions that they may not be able to get into for years. Not because of gatekeepers, but because so many people are trying to get in. There's so many people who want to get in. So I'm very conscious of how lucky and how blessed I've been. Also to change consciousness. So let's maybe dig a little deeper and let's really cast out net far and wide to get a diverse team of people to work on this production. So I'm always aware, not just holding on to what I've got, but how do I increase opportunities for others who want to do what I do, and having this exposure would further their careers. I'm very, very, very conscious of that. At one time, there were gatekeepers. I was only employed to do Lorraine Hansberry play. But now the opportunities are far and varied in terms of what I can direct. So I make sure that I make way for others, that I try and create paths or create spaces where others can enter into as well and get their opportunities to begin getting trained and exposed and learn what the language is of whatever genre I'm working in.
Absolutely. I think that's amazing. I think you help open up doors and avenues for minority groups that may not have had that opportunity elsewhere.
So I hope so. I really hope so. And again, you have to be very intentional. I just want to add, you have to be intentional about it. I have to say, well, this is going to be cast this way, and this, and I'm just not the man for your job. And I'm just not the man for it. If you're going to insist that this is the way it has to be, this is without compromising the material at all. I'm just saying, look, if we can't find a diverse team, or if we can't think about maybe casting an actor in a role that doesn't have to be, quote, Caucasian or something like that, okay, well, then we can't do that, then maybe I'm just not the artist for the job. Maybe I'm just not. And I'm willing to accept that. But I must say, they have been embracing and are embracing diversity and inclusion in a way. I hope it doesn't change, because the current administration is EDI, a dirty word, and renouncing it in many organizations. But theaters are savvy. They see that their audiences benefit from the variety, from the versatility you put up there on stage. The audiences benefit by it. Not, oh, well, they'll never want to see a play to African-American brothers who are poor. And if you make that decision and not bring it to your audience and all of them opportunity to see the play, then you're shortchanging your audience. You're shortchanging them. How do you know that they won't? why rely on other material when this is a Pulitzer Prize winner? It's not even a gamble. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Absolutely.
Like, come on.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not a gamble with it. It's not like an unknown playwright. So I'm very conscious of being it. Because I grew up there, man. When I was at NYU and whatnot, I could count on one hand the students of color that were there. The early days of my career in terms of being on sets and things like that count not just the people in front of the camera, but the people behind the camera who were the script supervisors, who were the grips, who were the director of photography. You know, being very conscious of how are we represented in these spaces. So having gone through it myself, I'm very, very aware and intentional about is anything I can do, anything to maybe vary this. A couple of talkbacks are scheduled. That's after the performance. Sit with the audience and talk about them. And they were looking for moderators to pass into Playhouse. And I suggested to one, an African-American female, amazingly intelligent woman, and another actor who also serves as an instructor. He actually also teaches. So I suggested them, and they're going to use them both. So then, again, creating conversations, creating abilities for opportunities for those who are ready, but they have to be asked. But I specifically gave them names of people who I thought, well, you know, not only would they make a great moderator for a talk back between audiences and on stage, but they're people of color, females of color. Let's get them in as well to facilitate that conversation. So there's always, you just have to be intentional. They are very aware of creating pathways and spaces for others to come through. That's the least I can do for the career that I've been blessed to have.
Absolutely. That is amazing for sure.
And you say you're an intern yourself.
Yes, sir.
I guess you're going through a learning I don't know how long you've been there, but I would say a learning process or in a space where, I don't know, do you have to tell me?
Yeah, very much. You are right on the money. I've only been here for maybe a month now.
Oh, my God. You really are a youngin. You really are. It's just an email. That's great. And now you're doing some interviews and things like that?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. We have to help each other. Each one teach one. Really.
Absolutely.
We have to help each other. It's the only way to go.
Absolutely. I agree with that notion 100%. Each one teach one.
That's right.
I was curious, when you guys were rehearsing and going through lines and just getting prepared for the show, has there been any point where you were going through a line and then, boom, it hits you? This line could actually mean something else, and it sparked something spontaneous and brand new on the spot that you decided to implement in the actual production and the premiere of the show.
There are still things that happen that way. What are you talking about? I read the play a million times before we start rehearsal. It's not until the actors come in and put it on a seat that suddenly I understand it's far more deeper. So this moment is about this. And then actors do it and go, oh, it could be about this, but it could also be about like five other things I hadn't thought about. Because I saw it happen as the actors were rehearsing. And that's the fun of it. Yes, I bring to it a certain amount of knowledge because I've read the play. I've read other reviews of the play. I've read critical studies of the play. Yeah, but that just earns me getting into the room. But then, because theater is of the heart, not just the head. So you get in there and you see the two people relating to each other. Suddenly a moment becomes crystal clear. That's what that's about. That's what it is. Okay. And seriously, I just had a revelation the other day when a suggestion was made from one of my design team members about a moment in the play. And as soon as she said it, I went, yes, that's what that moment is about. So I work very collaboratively. I'm really one of your best idea in the room kind of people. So ultimately, it falls on me to decide. But listen, why hire all these gifted, talented people if you're not going to listen to them? Not just the actors, but the costume sets, light, sound design. Listen to them. Listen for their take. So that's always for me. Juicy. That's delicious when suddenly I get a deeper and richer meaning of a line, a situation which I hadn't even thought of. It was the actors who opened the doors and made me think, oh, and that's so much richer that way. Yeah. So that happens all the time, even when you're up and running. These previews we're doing now reveal something different every night.
That's amazing. This play sounds like it is a stellar performance. And
you got to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to see it, champ.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it myself, honestly. Just doing the research and looking at the background on it, this seems very like an emotionally driven, great story. And being two black main actors is just that much more inspirational. I want to see how, like you said, everybody walks away with their own interpretation and message of the story. And I'm just curious for myself what I would take away from it.
Oh, yeah, you'll honor whatever your past is. You'll bring to it, hopefully, honestly. And whatever your past, whatever your orientations are, whatever's happened in your life and how you relate to that. But there's room for that in theater. There's room for that. There's no one message that has to be sent or slammed over your head. It's far more unique for you to take from it what you will based on what your experiences have been. That's far richer for me and far more challenging to an audience than trying to put out one message. Well, we should always, you guys are intelligent. You guys know what you're doing. You use your own background to complete the picture of this play.
Absolutely. You talked about that this hasn't been performed in the L.A. area in, would you say, about 20 years, right?
Yeah, I think the last time Mark Taper Forum did it, I believe it was 2002. Okay. I believe that's when it was had a production here at the Mark Taper Forum. So, again, it's one of those pearls of a play that I can't quite understand why. Mm-hmm. It's a small cast, two people. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner. I just don't know why it hasn't been mounted more, produced more. So we're very proud of the fact that we said, you know what, we're going to do this play. Again, it's just so well constructed. Just don't know why it hasn't been done more. I don't know. I don't know if it has something to do with her being black female. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's just as nefarious reasons, but I just curious why it hasn't been done. So yeah, this is the Los Angeles premiere of the play, as I know. It was done in Costa Mesa in 2014, but that's still 11 years ago. And that was down in Costa Mesa, Orange County. That was right. In the environs of Los Angeles. So last time in Los Angeles, 2002, I guess last time in the West Coast, that I recall is South Coast Repertory, and Costa Mesa did it. No, this has been delightful. Like I said, this has been delightful. I appreciate that you took the time to shed some light on this current project and maybe help us get some butts in the chairs.
Because right.
It's one thing to do the show, but you got to have people come see it. So far, we've had good previews. So there's interest in it, and interviews like yours will only help expose what we're doing right now in the Playhouse to more people.
Absolutely. I'm glad we could help, you know, get this story out.
Thank you, Mr. Shipman. I appreciate that. I really appreciate that. And it's been a pleasure. I really have enjoyed this very much, champ. Very much.
Thank you. As they say in theater, break a leg.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We black folk, we say take wings, but I know very well, break a leg. That's the common term, but we like to say take wings.
Gotcha.
Just between you, me, and the wall, we say take wings.
Gotcha. I'll be using that one from now on. I like that one better.
There you go. There you go. Take wings, y'all. So thank you, brother. I appreciate that.
That was KVCR's Champ Chipman in conversation with Greg T. Daniel, directing Top Dog Underdog at the Pasadena Playhouse, running through March 23rd. A reminder once again that they have a program in place where you can purchase a ticket and have it saved for someone who might not be able to afford a ticket due to being impacted by the recent LA fires. You can buy the ticket and have it saved for them. More at PasadenaPlayhouse.org. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Greg Daniel. And here at KVCR, thanks to Champ Chipman, Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.